As the power of protest continues throughout the country, more and more states are passing laws to criminalize fossil fuel protests.
It's a huge problem. We need to nip this in the bud if we're really committed to an open and robust democratic discourse.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, June 18th, how some states have been passing laws in the midst of the pandemic. Also, how COVID-19 has affected public summer camps, leaving families who rely on them without a way out.
It's playing out now. You have summer learning loss, and now we have COVID learning loss. And you have those with resources who are able to find solutions and those without.
And we round out the show with a conversation about the significance of Juneteenth with a 93-year-old activist in Texas who has fought to make it a national holiday.
And I keep thinking, we've made strides. And we say over and over, there's so much more that needs to be done.
But first, how the relationship between the press and police is evolving right now. As the uprising for racial justice continues across the country, journalists on the front lines are increasingly the targets of direct and hostile confrontations with law enforcement.
Who are you essential to? Get back.
We got plenty of time here.
Are you okay? Katie, are you okay?
We got stuck. Myself and the photographer got stuck in a corner at a scale brick wall and run into a random building where I'm now taking shelter.
I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay.
Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir?
Why am I under arrest, sir?
Being hit with tear gas and rubber bullets is part of the job for journalists covering conflict, but many of these incidents are drawing concerns from advocates about freedom of the press and about the strained relationships between media and the police. According to the Freedom of the Press Foundation and the Committee to Protect Journalists from earlier this month, over 80% of assaults on journalists came from police officers at recent demonstrations. Today, we're exploring how the relationship between police departments and the media got to this point. Joining me now is Simone Weichselbaum, national law enforcement reporter for the Marshall Project. Simone, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Also with us is Jim Mulvaney, adjunct professor in the Law and Police Science Department at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the former deputy managing editor at the New York Daily News, one of New York City's longest running tabloids. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jim, when you hear the interactions we described at the top of the show, what's your assessment about the tensions that are now existing between police and the press?
Well, we're in a very difficult time. This is much more like combat situations than it is like the old days of covering peaceful marches. The relationship between police and the press, if you look back in the 60s, everybody was turning blind eyes to some of the dalliances of the Kennedy administration all the way through the Giuliani administration. Reporters were taught to go along to get along. Things have changed, and the press is not willing to do that anymore.
And Jim, you started out as a reporter in the late 1970s. You've covered big investigations, including the Son of Sam murders in New York City. When you were doing that type of work, how did you build relationships with police officers?
I generally went directly to the police officers involved rather than their bosses or a public relations spokesman. Detectives, like all of us, are very proud of their work and they like to discuss it. And I would go out of my way to meet them usually 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to find out what had happened that day, sometimes significant, sometimes not. And just the fact that I showed interest led them to be more open with me.
Simone, you currently work with a lot of stories that directly involve police officers and others. You have deep sources in the community. How do you see that? What's the relationship for you as a journalist right now with the police?
To echo what Jim said, it really hasn't changed. I think a good deep source reporter, you don't need to rely on like the public affairs of a police department. I actually think that's lazy reporting or reporters who don't cover the subject. I spent a lot of my time just speaking to police chiefs, former police chiefs, a lot of union officials. And the whole point of that is, A, we need to talk to people directly involved in a situation. And a public affairs job of a police department is to spin the news. Their job is not to help a reporter get information. The Marshall Project, we approach the police beat, which I've been at the Marshall Project since we launched in 2014, more almost like academic. Like, let's look at the data. Let's get reports. We have time to file public records requests in FOIA. I also used to work at the Daily News. Shout out to the Daily News. And when you're a daily reporter, you may not have the time to wait 2 or 3 months for records to come back through a FOIA or public records request. But luckily for me at the Marshall Project, I do. So I build my stories not needing to rely on comment from a police department on record, because you'll never get your work done that way.
And you are able to, kind of what Jim was saying, like you also have relationships with police themselves where you can kind of have conversations with them and hear what they're thinking. Have those relationships changed, Simone, given the current state of affairs that we just described at the top of the show? There's more tension now.
Again, if you're a deep source reporter, you're talking to these folks every day anyway. And I'd say shout out, brave soul to the reporters on the front lines covering the protests. And I'm really sorry. And it's scary to see what has happened to them. But that's a different job from what I do. I try to look at policing. Why is it broken? Why are there broken systems in policing? And that's more an investigative beat. So I don't, thank God, have to be out there on the front lines and exposing myself to harm. You know, I, in a sense, have the luxury of sitting here putting together months-long projects with public records requests and data and speaking to the people. So I, at this point in my career, am able to build a police beat a lot different than what I was doing a couple years ago at the New York Daily News, when, yes, you are out there. I covered Zuccotti Park and the protests, the 1% protests, if your listeners remember that, like, what, 10 years ago now. That was a different time, too, but journalists were also assaulted back then. This is, like, not new for those of us covering policing.
So, Jim, how does this, what do journalists do right now in this scenario? We've seen, I mean, arrest of Omar Jimenez, for example, on television while he was filing a report for CNN. When it comes to, I mean, we heard audio from a journalist who was directly attacked with rubber bullets and who the officer saw that she was there with a crew. So what recourse do journalists have at this point?
The same recourse that they've always had. They just need to get along with the situation. I mean, the difference between what we're talking about here is Sonia's covering the police department. The reporters we're talking about are covering a live story. And the live story is very fluid, very violent, and tempers are high. And everybody needs to understand that. Sometimes you need to take a step back. If you're not a photographer, if you're not don't need actuality for radio, you don't need to get your nose right in the middle of things. It is very disrespectful for the police to be abusing reporters. Their job is not to critique the police. Their job is to cover the story. And if people are well-behaved, they should have no fear of reporters.
Simone, I want to Jim's point there, there's the one thing is covering protests and running into law enforcement there on the ground. There's another thing, which is covering police departments and just covering breaking news. For a lot of our listeners, that's a fire or a protest or something that just started happening. And in order to do that, at least in New York City, reporters have to go through the New York City Police Department to get a press pass. I mean, does that make sense to have journalists rely on the police department in order to get access to events that the police are essentially covering?
So as a Marshall Project reporter, very good point. I can't get an NYPD-issued police press pass. To get that, you have to get at least, you have to submit three clips, so three stories, or a photographer, three pictures that shows that in the last couple months, I covered three breaking news events. Therefore, I need this press pass. What does a press pass get you access to? More or less the front lines of a protest or a parade or something like that. I can get into the court building now with the Marshall Project business card. It's sometimes you get a hard time going to like a local court. I'm a national reporter, so I'm not always needing to go to like a New York City court. But it's problematic, but big cities do need a way to regulate like who are the working day-to-day journalists. New York City is a huge, huge media market. And I know from spending 6 years on the beat in the New York Daily News, you are flooded with freelancers. You're flooded with people who aren't journalists at all. You just want to maybe sell a video. People almost like paparazzi for crime. Yes, that's a thing. And I think those people aren't necessarily trained like we are, the day-to-day reporters who are out there who have cultivated the relationship with law enforcement. Would it be nice to have that process maybe go through the mayor's office or another office? Yes. But I can tell you, when I was at the Daily News, you always had to go upstairs to the top of police headquarters and apply for that press pass.
Jim, when you see what's happening on the ground here, I'm wondering, some of that has got to trickle down to folks who are, you know, the beat cops who are handling some of these protests. And I'm wondering if behind the scenes, and I'd love to hear from Simone, you as well, just in terms of behind the scenes, what are police officers really saying about, if they're saying anything about what they're seeing right now in terms of these increased hostile interactions with press?
I think that they're feeling quite disrespected. I mean, they're view is that their job is to fight crime and maintain order, and they're being faced with a situation of being picked on for things that have happened for hundreds of years that are beyond their control. And they're feeling a little bit powerless. And when one feels powerless, there is a natural reaction to lash out.
But they do. But Jim, to that point, I mean, they understand that the protesters are protesting one thing, but the press has a constitutional right to be at these protests.
Oh, I'm not denying that at all. What I'm saying is, you asked what an average cop thinks, and the average cop, just like a reporter on the beat, is not necessarily thinking long term. They're thinking immediate. So people are yelling at you, people are screaming at you, people are throwing stuff at you, and you're going to be frightened and angry. And I think that's how these things break down. It's not a good thing, and they should be trained better than to let a little shouting get under their skin.
Simone, what about you? Are law enforcement that you talk to even concerned about this at all, or do they just consider it part of the evolution of what's happening in this country, whether it's right or not?
So it's interesting that I speak to mainly police leaders, because I approach the beat more about police reform. So it's a different response than like the average cop on the street. So before, we had cries for defunding police or reimagining police. I say in the first few weeks or first few days of the George Floyd incident, I mean, no police chief thought what happened to George Floyd was okay. I mean, that was consensus. Then the defunding movement started. And in the first few days, people were saying, that's BS. That would never happen. But now you have the shift that city councils are actually voting to start taking away funding from police departments. Defunding, it's reimagining. That is the police term buzzword for those who are okay with, like, let's rethink police. The word they like to use, let's reimagine police. So even for the fact that they're at the point of, let's use the word reimagining police and let's rethink this, is a big step from, I would say, 6 weeks ago before policing was in the national spotlight again.
Jim, we've got about a minute left in the segment. What do you think can be done to improve the relationship between journalists and police departments?
I do think that police reporters need to be spending more time with police and having open and frank discussions. When it's almost like a dress rehearsal. If you're in the middle of the stuff, people are not always going to behave well. At the Daily News, we had a special program to take police reporters to shooting ranges with cops and show them how quickly things happen when things go bad. It was a real eye-opener for both the police and the reporters to understand how difficult both jobs were.
Jim Mulvaney is an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Simone Weichselbaum is the national law enforcement reporter for the Marshall Project. Simone, Jim, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The power of protest is on full display across the country in the movement against racial injustice. At the same time, a number of states have passed laws that could criminalize fossil fuel protests. Kentucky, South Dakota, and West Virginia have joined a dozen states that already have similar legislation on the books. And at least five more states, including Mississippi, are considering legislation that would criminalize environmental protests in the future. To understand what this could mean for our First Amendment rights, I spoke with Alex Kaufman, senior climate reporter at HuffPost, and Ron Krodzinski, the John S. Stone Chair at the University of Alabama School of Law and the author of The Disappearing First Amendment. So I asked Ron what the First Amendment says about Americans' rights to attend any protest, including an environmental one.
Under the First Amendment, we talk about freedom of speech a lot, but the amendment actually speaks to other kinds of expressive freedoms, too, including assembly and petition. And so if individuals, for example, with the Black Lives Movement, want to gather in public as a group to express their views, to speak their version of truth to power, and to petition their government, whether local, state, or federal, to amend policies to address those concerns, our Constitution, going back to 1791 and adoption of the Bill of Rights, secures that quite strongly. Not absolutely, but quite strongly.
So how exactly are some states criminalizing environmental protests specifically?
So the bill, when it's modified state by state, creates enhanced criminal penalties for trespass and for damage to fossil fuel facilities, including pipelines. The other thing these laws do is create vicarious or third-party liability for individuals who direct, advise, encourage, solicit, cause, or incite. These are words taken from the statutes, someone else to trespass or damage after trespassing fossil fuel company property. And the problem is, if a speaker at an environmental protest, in any fossil fuel protest, says something like, let's stop this pipeline now, or we must stop this pipeline, exclamation point, they, in theory, could be charged with directing, causing, inciting, advising, encouraging subsequent bad behavior by someone who trespasses and then damages company property. You essentially are requiring, in theory, protest organizers to indemnify fossil fuel companies for any damage that happens to be caused by someone who merely attended an event. And this would have a profound and deeply troubling chilling effect on environmental public protest. It would essentially make protest organizers financially and criminally responsible for random bad acts by someone from the public who happened to attend a rally. Suppose Greta Thunberg, the Swedish activist, came to South Dakota, had an anti-fossil fuels rally, and said, fossil fuels are immoral, we've got to stop these pipeline projects. If someone who attended that rally, or a group of people who attended that rally, at some point down the road, indefinitely down the road, were to then trespass or damage the pipeline owner could seek to impose civil liability on Greta, and or the state of South Dakota could bring criminal charges against her, even though there's no proof whatsoever of any coordination, conspiracy, aiding or abetting. Greta Thunberg is just engaged in environmental protest, environmental speech. She has nothing whatsoever to do with any subsequent bad acts, but these laws seek to create a threat of legal liability on individuals or organizations that sponsor anti-pipeline or anti-fossil fuels public protest. That would obviously make it much more difficult and raise the stakes considerably and lead to self-censorship by people who are legitimately concerned about greenhouse gas and non-renewable forms of energy. The idea is to create this sort of free-floating threat of legal liability, perhaps even without ever anticipating using that threat. The chilling effect is the same, and in some ways the chilling effect is better if you don't actually pull the trigger and charge them, because they won't know for certain whether the First Amendment claim is good until they're facing civil or criminal liability, which could be bankrupting to their organizations. It's really clever and insidious in the way it's set up.
Now, Ron, I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I'm just curious here whether or not states' rights, and in this case, states that are crafting this type of legislation, trump the Constitution and the right to free speech. I mean, where does that line get drawn?
Well, under Article 6 of the Constitution, there's something called the Supremacy Clause, and judges, both federal and state, take an oath that promises to place federal law, including the Constitution and Bill of Rights, over and above state law. So normally, if a state law violated a First Amendment right, both state and federal judges would have an obligation to enforce the federal right, and particularly the First Amendment. The problem, though, is that we have a recent Fifth Circuit case called Doe v. McKesson, in which the Fifth Circuit allowed a suit to go forward against the organizer of a Black Lives Matter protest in Baton Rouge. A rock or brick was thrown at a policeman. He was injured. He didn't know who threw it. He actually sued the hashtag as well as the local organizer of the protest. And the district court dismissed the litigation, but the Fifth Circuit, amazingly, incorrectly in my view, permitted the policeman's lawsuit to proceed against the organizer of the protest. And this is a form of vicarious or joint and several liability. There's no evidence whatsoever that Mr. McKesson in any way, shape, or form encouraged or facilitated directly the battery of the policeman. It should be a First Amendment violation, but the Fifth Circuit says it isn't. It's a problem.
Alex, you've been covering this for quite some time now. When did you start to see the sort of trend of legalization to criminalize fossil fuel protests?
So it was really in the year after the Dakota Access Pipeline was completed, soon after Trump came into office. The Dakota Access fight was a real firestorm in late 2016 and drew a lot of outrage from some in the industry who were frustrated by the resources and attention that were being placed on those opposing that project. And sure enough, in the months that followed its completion, you saw the shopping around of a model bill from the American legislature. Legislative Exchange Council, the conservative policy shop that sought to up the penalties for protesting against projects like this. And so in the wake of that, you know, throughout 2018 and then throughout 2019, and again, a major uptick since the pandemic began in March, you've seen these bills making their way through state legislatures.
Let's talk about who's behind this legislation. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. First of all, let's talk about who the American Legislative Exchange Council is and what their involvement in crafting some of this legislation has been so far.
So ALEC is a big policy shop that is known in some circles as a dark money group. It does not always have to disclose all of its donors, and its donors often include very large corporations. There are some companies that have distanced themselves from ALEC over the years, including Exxon, but overwhelmingly the fossil fuel industry has been a major donor and participant in what it does. It also operates in many other spheres, you know, fighting against students on campuses who protest against controversial and often racist speakers, you know, fighting against LGBT rights, and carrying out various other things that are considered to be part of the agenda of the right wing of the Republican Party. But this has been a particular cause of that organization for some time. They have been actively promoting this in coordination with members of the industry. So you have had, you know, trade associations that Exxon, Marathon Petroleum, Chevron are a part of that are actively pushing this model bill that they put together. And you have individual companies that have been actively lobbying some of the lawmakers who are behind these bills. It's not always easy to tell from the lobbying disclosures that different states provide on which bills companies have lobbied, but there is evidence that lobbyists working on behalf of these companies have lobbied the lawmakers who have proposed and championed this legislation.
So basically, and Ron, it sounds like these laws are being targeted to a specific viewpoint and essentially in this case against people who are against fossil fuels. Is that legal? And this is something that we hear a lot from advocates of free speech. Doesn't the First Amendment cover all points of view?
These laws do appear to be viewpoint-based. They are, I think, designed to have a chilling effect on any fossil fuel, any pipeline public protest. The problem, I think, is that on their face, many of these laws target unlawful conduct. Where regulation of conduct implicates speech, so long as a court finds that the primary purpose for enacting the law was unrelated to suppression of the viewpoint, then it passes First Amendment muster. And there's a fairly terrible case, if memory serves, written by Chief Justice Warren called O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien burned his draft card, and the Congress had enhanced the penalties for draft card burning during the anti-Vietnam War protests. And the Supreme Court, in an act of stunning willful blindness, said that Congress was simply concerned with the administrative efficiency of the Selective Service system and was unconcerned completely with suppressing anti-Vietnam War viewpoints. So the problem is that while a viewpoint-based law is subject to strict scrutiny and usually will fail, a lot of times federal judges are willfully blind to the real motivation of a law. And what these state governments are going to say is that these laws are designed to protect critical infrastructure in a time of global pandemic, and therefore targeted protection is needed because these facilities require targeted and special protection. That feels bogus to me, but if you were to ask the Fifth Circuit judges who held Mr. McKesson potentially legally responsible for the bad act of someone who happened to be at the protest, I fear what the answer would be. You're exactly right. These should be deemed viewpoint-based, and they should be subject to strict scrutiny. I am not confident that's how it would work out with 200 very conservative judges. Conservative not in an institutional way, conservative in a kind of nakedly partisan or ideological way.
The Trump administration has been very clear in its opposition to the Obama-era environmental changes that were put in place. Alex, are you noticing that certain states where this new legislation is being pushed, are those states in line politically with where the president is? And does that theory hold true right now?
Certainly. I mean, it hasn't only been Republicans, notably the Democratic governor of Kentucky approved one of the first laws of these to pass during the pandemic, although it was a significantly watered down version of what had been initially proposed. But these are overwhelmingly in red states. Now, these are still early days. There have not been many prosecutions done under these laws as it stands. There is one case that is currently working its way through the courts in Texas, where about half a dozen Greenpeace protesters who suspended themselves from a bridge over a very busy shipping canal down on the Texas coast and temporarily halted the movement of refined petroleum are being charged under this. And you're likely to see more. I mean, we are expecting for this year to be one, you know, once construction can reopen and states are fully reopened for business like that, there's going to be a big push around completing a lot of pipeline projects that had been held up in the courts or held up because of environmental review. And the administration has, through executive order, decided to roll back what the environmental reviews that are actually required to complete certain projects. So as those things push forward, you can expect that there will be more protests, and I would expect to see a lot more testing of these charges in court.
In advance of those protests, Alex, to that point, I'm wondering, the question is always, you know, what is the counter legal approach happening here? You know, are environmental activists and people who are coming out to organize these protests, are they preparing to counter this current legal argument that's being made?
I mean, certainly the better funded and more litigious environmental groups are keeping an eye on this and are pushing back against it. But I think it's worth noting that a lot of those resources so far have just been focused on trying to protect the existing environmental safeguards that we've had and that are actively being rolled back. So, you know, this has been, I think, a fight that has gone under-examined and one that is really ripe for some type of conflict once somebody is charged. But at the moment, I think a lot of the groups that are actively suing the administration and are actively putting together legal strategies to defend environmental rules are really focused on just trying to protect the scant environmental protections that already existed.
Ron, you mentioned a Black Lives Matter protest and the use of this idea of vicarious liability in that case. As you are well aware, none of us can ignore the fact that we are collectively in a moment of protest in the country. We are now in the third week of nonstop protests for racial justice and against police brutality. Do you see the use of vicarious liability being extended to potentially suppress different protests for racial justice, for Black Lives Matter, for women who are speaking out against discrimination? Like the list goes on and on.
It terrifies me in terms of its potential chilling effect. And to go back to something that Alex mentioned, I would predict in terms of vicarious liability provisions, the causes, encourages, directs, advises, I don't think we're going to see a lot of charges brought on those facts, because that would allow a protest organizer to bring that First Amendment challenge. The utility of these laws really is the interim effect they could have. So if a Greta Thunberg wants to give a speech in South Dakota, she needs to think carefully about what she says. Can she say, stop this pipeline now? Or does she need to make a more nuanced argument for fear that she or her organization might face criminal or civil liability if someone later trespasses and damages construction equipment for a pipeline? There's also a kind of resonance with a number of state laws that prohibit using fraud or false pretenses to gain access to industrial farming facilities. These are so-called ag-gag laws. A number of states, I think over a dozen, have adopted them. They also prohibit non-consented to recordation of industrial farming practices. And you can see why. If you show animals being treated really terribly, tortured, that's going to create a public dialogue that might lead to state or federal regulation prohibiting particularly egregious industrial farming practices. Rather than addressing animal cruelty, a number of state legislatures have adopted laws to make it harder to gain access to these facilities to record these behaviors. That's part of these fossil fuel laws, too. A number of the draft bills, one in Alabama, for example, prohibited using a drone to simply photograph a pipeline existing or under construction. So a part of this model legislation is aimed squarely at prohibiting news gathering that would then help inform the dialogue that would move public policy on these questions. And so with AGGAG, environmental protest, with the McKesson case, yes, it seems to me that there's a concerted effort to sort of raise the stakes by threatening vicarious liability on protest organizers who have in no way whatsoever directly conspired or aided or abetted a trespass or damage to property. It's really crucial, I think, that if we have a free speech court and conservative members of the Supreme Court like John Roberts like to proclaim how absolute their commitment to the First Amendment is, they need to grant cert in the McKesson v. Doe case from the Fifth Circuit and make clear that decisions like Watts, Brandenburg, and a case called Claiborne Hardware, which all say you can engage in hyperbolic speech without being criminally or civilly punished, that these cases, these precedents, preclude the imposition of vicarious liability in organizations like Greenpeace that organize a peaceful rally, which is followed perhaps by individuals engaging in unlawful acts as acts of civil disobedience. Another analogy is to slap suits, and there are anti-slap suit statutes in some states. That's a strategic litigation against public participation. These feel like slap statutes in that they create this kind of free-floating potential liability, which has the effect of stifling public discourse, and it has the purpose of stifling that public discourse. I think the goal is to impede or delay a national consensus about moving toward renewable energy. You think about the Tobacco Institute and the tobacco companies from the time of the Surgeon General to the settlements in the late 90s, early 2000s. There's a real strategic and financial advantage to simply delaying a social consensus about something like, you know, the morality and desirability of non-renewable carbon fuels. And so if these protests are inhibited and the consensus is delayed, you know, think about the Green New Deal, that's an opportunity to move natural gas and oil in the interim and to, you know, take financial advantage of these strategic investments these companies have made. It makes perfect sense. It's a very low-cost investment in trying to preserve your ability to do business. I feel like I'm sounding a little bit like Who Framed Roger Rabbit with Detroit and the trolleys, streetcars in L.A., but it's the same sort of motive, I think, for business. We want to keep doing business as we've always done it, and these protesters are in the way.
Ron Krodzinski is the John S. Stone Chair at the University of Alabama School of Law, and Alex Kaufman is a senior climate reporter at HuffPost. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
In New York City, where more than 20,000 people have died from COVID-19 so far, the city is facing major budget cuts and the closure of these programs feels especially acute. Mayor Bill de Blasio released a budget proposal that would make $235 million worth of cuts to public summer programs. And in April, the city canceled its Summer Youth Employment Program, which last year helped place nearly 75,000 kids and young adults between the ages of 14 to 24 in jobs. And that could leave thousands of families in New York without the programs or childcare they need while the pandemic continues. To talk about this and how it's playing out nationwide, I've got Aaron Philip Dworkin, the CEO of the National Summer Learning Association, with me, and Rima Amin, a reporter for Chalkbeat, to talk about how this is playing out in New York.
These programs that we're talking about, I mean, if you just talk about summer youth employment alone, thousands of kids who participate are from low-income families. Last year, 85% of the kids who got jobs through this program reported incomes of about $31,000 or less from their families. So these are children who are earning work experience, who are earning paychecks, and then bringing that money home. And especially in a time when families are suffering from the economic fallout, possibly dealing with job losses, many in the community had sort of looked to this program and thought this will be extra income during the year. And with the prospect of it being canceled that I think is worrying to many low-income families. And if you have, if you're a more affluent family, you have access to private day camps, you know, in terms of the day camp offerings for younger children, you can afford to pay the fees that are associated with that. But the divide comes when you're a family who can't really afford that and would have relied on a subsidized program.
Right. And I'm curious, Aaron, whether or not what we're seeing here in New York, particularly the income divide that, you know, Rima was just discussing, is playing out nationally. Because on the one hand, we have kids who are going to lose summer work, who actually could have used that money. They're not just working because it's good experience. They're working to actually bring money into the household. And on the other hand, you have kids who just won't have access to publicly funded recreational facilities. So are you seeing that nationally?
Absolutely. And it's so interesting. It's a microcosm for the rest of the country. Our organization's been around for more than 25 years, and summer learning loss has always been a major equity issue. It's one of the largest examples of inequity in all of education is what happens over the summer months. So this is not new. People and educators and program providers have been tackling these divides and gaps that grow over the summer months more dramatically than any other time. It's playing out now. You have summer learning loss, and now we have COVID learning loss. And you have those with resources who are able to find solutions, and those without who are really struggling and being impacted. I think what we do see across the country are different examples, and the COVID cases are different in different parts of the country as well. But those that are being successful, in our opinion, are those that are most hyper creative and hyper collaborative. And if we just want to stay on the example of youth employment in the city of Charlotte, instead of initially canceling, their leader, Dawn Hill, working for the mayor, went and approached all the business job providers and said, listen, I know you're struggling, but don't cancel these jobs. Can we come up with another solution? And initially, right off the bat, they were all agreeing to fund young people to get trained in Microsoft programs and LinkedIn learning programs until they had more time to figure out what they needed and then could come up with project, but that young people would be paid over the summer. And they agreed to that, and also to extend those jobs past the summer into the fall. So there are examples of out-of-the-box, more collaborative examples that I think are the solutions we need right now.
Rima, you've been talking, we've been talking here about the loss of a lot of these public summer program providers in New York City. Mayor de Blasio here in New York has cited the budget shortfall that's forcing him, in his opinion, to make these decisions. What are you hearing from the providers here, according to, you know, how are they responding to Mayor de Blasio's proposed cuts?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the most generous term here would be anxiety. And I do want to note that the mayor has announced that after a lot of public pressure, that they are going to find some funding sources for both SYEP, the Summer Youth Employment Program, as well as these day camps, these subsidized day camps. So providers are basically in the situation now where they have a sense that there is going to be some funding coming in, but there is no sense of how much that's going to be. So, you know, in terms of the day camps, those providers are having to tell their folks who work on these programs that, hey, come June 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year here, that we might have to lay you off, we might have to furlough you, or we might have to, you know, New York's biggest after school provider, New York Edge, recently told 1,700 employees that they're going to be moving to a 2-day work week starting June 29th. So the issue there comes that you might have employees who decide, hey, for me and my family, it's better that I quit this job and try to search for something else. Or maybe I can, you know, devote my energy elsewhere, maybe find other work. This makes it tough for providers to plan for the summer because A, they don't know how much money they're getting, if any at all. And B, they might be losing the very workers who would help them make programs and program options for kids, you know, when the funding comes in. So it's sort of this big question mark.
Aaron, one thing that often gets lost in the conversation when we talk about education and school for low-income folks is that a lot of people, many low-income families throughout the country, rely on not only the facility, but also the subsidized or free meal programs that continue often throughout the summer. Do you know if food scarcity is going to be a problem for some children and their families if these summer programs are not available this summer?
Yes, no, absolutely, without a fact. Hunger and nutrition issues over the summer are major areas of concern that a lot of folks are addressing, groups like No Kid Hungry, Food Research Action Council, but they say the research shows that only 1 in 7 youth that are eligible during the school year for free and reduced lunch meals actually are in programs that can access them in the summer. And so it's already a problem, and now you'll have less programs. So there, I will, to the credit of the federal government, they're creating a lot of waivers and flexibility now. You don't have to be in a program to access the meals or the pickup. And there's a lot of focus on this and as much flexibility as possible. But it's a huge concern because those programs typically are where a lot of young people get 2 to 3 meals a day.
Another thing that's come up in the conversation of parenting in a COVID world is the question of childcare. We saw so many parents, wealthy, not wealthy, people who were just struggling to get through distance and online learning, partly because their childcare had been taken away. The schools also represented an opportunity for folks to have their kids somewhere else while they went to work. But many of the basic childcare that many parents were used to was also taken away. Rima, summer programs provide that childcare. What's going to happen to low-income families this summer who don't have that?
Yeah, so this is a really important point for providers and families alike. I just talked to a mother yesterday. She is raising 2 middle school sons, 6th grade and 7th grade, on her own. She's a widow, and she was recently laid off from a city job. And so she was, her kids have been participating in an after-school program provided by New York Edge. And she was looking to the summer program as a way for her sons to continue meeting new kids. They're sort of new to the area. They live in Brooklyn. So that was going to be something that she was sort of going to lean on while she searched for new work, while she got things done during the day that she needed to for her family. And now that's sort of in limbo. And I think, you know, providers I've talked to have said that they serve literally thousands of low-income families. And the one big concern now is that New York City is slowly starting to go through these reopening phases where different businesses are reopening. And as families who have been potentially out of work for months are going back out pursuing work, they're going to need some sort of childcare that they can at least, you know, not have to pay for at least part of the day. And not having access to these programs could really hurt that.
Erin, I am loath to ask you a question that is going to add even more work to what parents, particularly low-income parents, are going to deal with this summer. But I've got to ask, are there any suggestions for parents who won't have access to summer programs for their kids this year? I'm thinking, I grew up in public housing. Those apartments are small, they're dense, they're hot. And I just can't imagine, you know, not having some outlet for that. So what can parents do this summer?
There are a lot of resources for parents, and a lot of groups are trying to make those available for free. Unfortunately, all the digital divide issues are still significant. But if you have access to a computer and you have access to the internet, there are a lot of free curriculum out there. And I think our recommendations are, you know, first, we have to take care of their health. And there's a lot of trauma going on. And if you just do something that both will keep them physically active or on the nutrition side and also social, emotionally, like check in with them. There's a lot of curriculum from Sanford Harmony that's free, and Castle that's free. And we have a lot of resources on our website, summerlearning.org, to make sure they get ready for school. We can't use this summer to make up for everything we've missed over the last few months. And by the way, this is going to be going on for the effects of this COVID will be next summer as well. But every student has one area that they could improve on that's maybe a high need area. Talk to your school, talk to a teacher, find out what is it, reading, is it math, is it STEM, find something. And there's a ton of curriculum and free hands-on. Khan Academy has great resources for students to activate. And the last thing here, like the moment we're in, this is a politically charged moment, and students are not unaware whether it's how to respond to the COVID issues or the structural racism challenges we're seeing in our country play out right now. And so, and with the big election. So I would just say, like, find a way to empower your student to get involved and be, you know, do service and take a leadership role.
Well, there you heard it. Erin Philip Dworkin is the CEO of the National Summer Learning Association. And Rima Amin is a reporter for Chalkbeat. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Tomorrow is Juneteenth, and awareness of the holiday has reached an all-time high following weeks of protests for racial justice in the United States. Juneteenth commemorates the day when enslaved people in Texas learned about their emancipation, June 19, 1865. That's a full 2.5 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Black Americans have long celebrated Juneteenth, and though Texas recognized it as a state holiday in 1980, followed by dozens of other states, it has yet to become a national holiday. And for years, Opal Lee has been working to get Juneteenth recognized as a national holiday. The 93-year-old is a social impact leader in Fort Worth, Texas, and she joins me now. Opal, thank you for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
What does Juneteenth mean to you, Opal?
It means so much, and I hope I can express it. It means freedom. And I don't know if you can understand a people who were subjugated so long that when they found out they were free, they began celebrating, and we've been celebrating ever since.
Opal, the significance of Juneteenth is deeply personal for you.
Yes.
Tell me what happened to your family's home when you were 12 years old.
We moved to Fort Worth from Marshall, Texas in 1937. My parents worked hard and were able to pay down on a house at the corner of Annie and New York Street, Fort Worth, called the South Side. My mom had it fixed up so neat. But people began to gather, throw rocks. And on the 19th day of June, the newspaper says 500 of them gathered. And, well, my dad wasn't there. He was at work. When he came, he had a gun. And the police told him if he burst the cap, they'd let that mob have. Well, they sent us, the three of us, me and my two brothers, to neighbors on Terrell Avenue. And they stayed. But eventually, they had to leave because the mob burned the place, drug out the furniture, and they had to leave. My parents never told us about it, never talked to us about it. And they struggled some more, and we bought another house on Terrell Avenue. I don't know what to tell you. I didn't have any, what is the word, epiphany? I simply knew as I grew up that there were things that needed to be done.
Opal, you, in talking about the work that you've done across the course of your lifetime, among the many things that you've done, you've also led a campaign to get Juneteenth recognized as a national holiday. Tell me about what made you want to pursue that.
My family has always celebrated Juneteenth. And when I learned that General Gordon Granger and black troops landed in Galveston and told people, in fact, he read what was called General Order Number 3 to the people, saying that slaves were free. He nailed that to the door, that order, he nailed it to the door of Reedy Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church. And when the slaves came in from work and somebody read that to them, they began celebrating. And so we've been celebrating ever since. Now, celebrations are just not a festival for us. We have already in Fort Worth had our flag raising. We've already had our breakfast of prayer. That's not to be confused with a prayer breakfast. And we are about to have our caravan. Because of the virus, we can't have a parade, and we love a parade. We are going to leave downtown to Lancaster and all the way out to Will Rogers Auditorium. and that's a 2.5 mile walk. And I'll be walking it, and the cars will be behind me to symbolize that slaves didn't know we were free for 2.5 years. The components with Juneteenth, the educational components, the art, the music, the empowering you, all these things are a part of Juneteenth. Because when slaves got free, when they were free, they had 12 freedoms that they had gained. They gained the ability to name themselves, to have their children not taken away from them, to buy land, to educate themselves. There were so many more things that they gained. And still, this day and time, we've not gained those freedoms. And I keep thinking, we've made strides. And we say over and over, there's so much more that needs to be done. I see Juneteenth as a unifier. I even advocate that we do Juneteenth from the 19th to the 4th of July. You know, slaves weren't free on the 4th of July. And we'd have so many more opportunities to make people aware.
There are a couple of observations I'd love to hear from you. When you see what's happening with the racial justice uprising right now, with people protesting now 3 weeks straight in the United States across the country, what are your observations of that? How does that make you feel?
That I wish I was young enough to get protest. I'd be afraid I'd give those kids something as old as I am. So I stay home. But I can understand enough is enough. And the only way we know how to get attention is to protest. I don't condone the looting and the killing and that sort of thing. But we've got to sit down with people and discuss what's happening and alleviate the situation. Our educational system needs, oh, so much work. The job disparities, the homelessness, the health. There's so much that could be done if we would just work together. And the fact that the color of my skin is the reason you don't work with me is so, it's just plain ignorance.
Opal, is that ignorance something that's a product of our education system here in the United States? Because your family has celebrated Juneteenth. You have led a national movement to bring awareness, but also make Juneteenth a federal holiday. And yet, people are just learning about Juneteenth. What does that say to you when you look at the education that folks in this country have or don't have when it comes to the legacy of slavery and the history of slavery of Black people in this country?
It's not taught in the schools. What they do have is a shame. Pictures of people picking cotton and folks having the impression that they like doing this. I pick cotton, and I know it's not something that you'd be proud you're doing. My thing is, our education system needs to be better. But we can't bring the education system all together because people learn this at home. They learn to dislike. They learn to hate. They don't get it all from the school system.
Opal, what would you like to see the Juneteenth holiday evolve into here in the United States? How do you think this holiday should be celebrated?
I enjoy the celebrations that we have. I'm just wanting more people to know why we celebrate and to join us. The protests, listen, those are not all Black people out there protesting. These are people of all nationalities. And why can't we get our system regulated to address the atrocities that are happening to all people. To us, it's more visible. But to Mexican Americans and Asian Americans and all kind of people who are suffering, I'm so unhappy about what's happening to the immigrants and the children taken from their parents. I don't know what I would do if somebody took my children from me. Thank God they're in their 70s. So we are wanting people to understand that Juneteenth is a unifier. Let's get together and address these atrocities. Let's get together and tweak our educational system. Let's get together and find decent jobs so people can have a decent home. Let's eradicate homelessness. I think I'm preaching.
Nothing wrong with preaching, Opal. We appreciate it. Opal Lee is a social impact leader based in Fort Worth, Texas, who's been working to get Juneteenth recognized as a national holiday for years. Opal, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and to sharing your years of experience and wisdom with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll meet again. Don't know.
And that's it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. We have to give a quick shout out to the Takeaway team that works to make this show as good as it is every week. Our board operator, Debbie Daughtry, was in the studio at WNYC for us, alongside director and sound designer, Jake Howitt. Alexandra Botee is our senior producer. Our producers are Jackie Martin, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Dina Syed Ahmed. Polly Arungu is our digital editor, Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our administrative assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Our love and thoughts to the family of singer Vera Lynn, who was a star of the World War II era and passed away this week at age 103. It's a good track to leave you with. Thanks so much for listening. Amy Walter's in tomorrow. I'll be back with you on Monday. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.